Okay, so I'm going to talk about strong hyperbolicity. At first I thought I was going to use the blackboard just to keep the seminar informal, but yesterday I got my fortune cookie says, assert yourself, your ideas are worthwhile. So I decided to use this thing, and also because I have too many formulas at the end. So my collaborators on this. And so let's go now to the outline. So I'll be giving some introduction, definitions, and examples of strongly hyperbolic systems. Then I'm going to move to a covariant definition of hyperbolicity, strong hyperbolicity, on the same footing as symmetric hyperbolicity that is amenable to a covariant definition, so to be used in general relativity in a general setting. Then I'm going to discuss causality problems in strong hyperbolic systems. For symmetric hyperbolic system, that is easy. It's very natural. You use energy norms and you prove causality so that waves propagate with finite speeds. For strong hyperbolic system, you still have a notion of speed. You still, they are finite, but it's very hard to prove that the signals propagate with finite speed. So I'm going to talk about this. And then I'm going to discuss two applications. One is studying the hyperbolicity of ADM and BSSN theories. These are theories which are second order in space. So while the definition of strong hyperbolicity are first order in space and time, so here we are going to transfer these equations into pseudo-differential equations which are strongly hyperbolic in defining new variables, but not the usual variables where you expand your system and get 5,000 equations, but just a way of writing the same amount of equations but treating this system as first order system. It's no longer a differential system, it's a pseudo differential system, but you can treat everything. So here in the middle there will be a definition of strongly hyperbolicity for pseudo differential equations. And then I'm going to talk about this hyperbolicity of the subsidiary system. By that I mean if you have an evolution equation which also has constraints, and you have an integrability condition for those constraints, you would like to know the properties of this, the evolution of the constraints, that's what we call subsidiary system, from the properties of the evolution system. And we will see that there are cases where you can say a lot of this. In particular, if you have a strongly hyperbolic system, your subsidiary system also is strongly hyperbolic, modulo some conditions I'm going to introduce. But it's not true that if you have a symmetric hyperbolic system, your subsidiary system is going to be symmetric hyperbolic. So that's why we need this strongly hyperbolicity condition there.
If I could just begin the stupid questions here. I mean, is hyperbolicity, strong hyperbolicity, symmetric hyperbolicity, are they properties of the theory, like general relativity, or are they properties of a particular way of writing the
theory? The way of writing the equations. If you have constraints, there are many ways because you have the gauge freedom.
So we can't say general relativity.
No, it will be nice to have a theory. Bob was working in this to try to introduce, to keep the gauge freedom there and say even when you have a gauge freedom, what is strongly hyperbolicity is. So that you will say, okay, this theory in principle by a geometric, an algebraic property is strongly hyperbolic, even though that you need to introduce some gauge, etc. later to render it strongly hyperbolic at the end, really, in the mathematical definition.
So GR is strongly hyperbolic in some particular gauge.
Right. So GR is symmetric hyperbolic in many gauges and is strongly hyperbolic also. And
can I enter a plea for some of us have been spending too much of our time on the Euclidean section?
Yeah. Okay.
Also, is there an order?
Yeah.
I mean, symmetric
implies strong, implies hyperbolicity, or? Yes, symmetric implies strong hyperbolicity, not the other way around. And you have still weak hyperbolicity, which is, I'm going to discuss it later, which is a weaker definition.
What about the Ray hyperbolicity?
That's a tough question. Lorentz hyperbolicity is another type of hyperbolicity where the norms you use or the topology you use to show well-posedness is different.
I agree with Jimmy, we should let you start. I just wanted to sort of see.
No, I mean, we can keep it sort of informal, so we can.
It's partly mathematical definitions fault. They can't cover it.
So let's start with a constant coefficient system, first order system, right? So you have a system like this. This matrix A alpha beta are constant coefficients. So it's a matrix, right? You have a U alpha as a set of variables, say a vector. And then you have this equation, which is an evolution equation. So you have a derivative of T for each one of these ones. And so the question is when this system is well posed in the L2 sense. Namely, when can you bound the solution at some time t with respect to the initial value, the initial values of u, right? So this is a question, and the answer is, well, this is well posed, so there is an inequality like this, if and only if for every omega I, the matrix that you form this way has only real eigenvalues and a complete set of eigenvectors. This is an if and only if.
C is independent of time, right?
Yes. Well, this is for a given time. So you might think of C of either C is a function of time, but not a function of the initial data, or you are taking a slab, just a region from 0 to some finite t.
Well, why isn't it always true of C to be a function of time?
Because it could be that it depends on the initial data. Right. So if this doesn't happen, then you can choose initial data for which the initial norm is always 1, while this is going to grow unbounded for any fixed t. Right. So that means that, for instance, there is no hope of having a code which is stable in that case, because you will have a error which could be the highest frequency, a very small error, and if you increase your solution at the end, say at time m, will grow unbounded. That's what happens. So this is a if and only if result. So you have a system like that, constant coefficients, you know this. And unfortunately, there are ways of writing Einstein's equations in which this is not true. Right? So it's unstable.
Constant coefficients is almost
never true. I mean, but even with the variable coefficients, because the thing here is that if this is for the quasi-linear case, if this is not satisfied, then it's easy to find counterexamples, namely data with this property that will blow up, just because you just take a smooth data and superimpose on it a data which is a high-frequency data, very small. So everything here will be almost constant. You will not notice on the coefficients, but nevertheless, the solution will blow. So I'm going to go to that, but in the quasi-linear case. So, and the proof of that is easy. You just go to Fourier transform in space. You get this equation. The solution of that equation is this one. I have a T missing here. And so you can bound the L2 norm of U using Plancherel by the L2 norm of the Fourier transform. And this is bounded by this, where this C is this thing here with a T here, I'm forgetting. And this, again, you can bound by Plancherel by this thing, right? So the constant C that appears here is the maximum that this quantity acquires in this interval and over all omegas. Right. So what you need is this thing has to be finite, bounded by all t and all omegas, and that's yeah. There is a tau here that I guess is the phone that is missing.
Should be there.
Yeah, should be there. So there is a tau and an omega. And so the question is, when is this matrix bounded, right? And this matrix is bounded if the eigenvalues are real and there is a complete set of eigenvectors. Right? If not, it's not bounded. So very straightforward. When you go to quasi-linear systems, So now you allow the A to depend on U, and you have a lower order term like that, general. Then you can show that the above system is well posed in some Sobolev norm now, not an L2 norm, but it's a more complicated norm that takes care of derivative, also the L2 norm of some derivative, some finite number of derivatives. And now you say, in a neighborhood of some solution, if these matrices in this neighborhood also have real eigenvalues and a complete set of eigenvectors. And there is some technical condition I'm going to describe later that you have to add to this. But basically, it's the same. So it's an algebraic condition on this matrix. And if that system satisfies this condition, we call this system strongly hyperbolic. Right? So strongly hyperbolic systems are, again, systems where this matrix, when you dot it with some omega I here, has this property as a metric for any omega.
Maybe you could at this stage say what the metric hyperbolic is.
Would you repeat the question?
Yeah, I'm. It's coming in the next one. So if you can prove that if a system is strongly hyperbolic, then there exists a positive definite bilinear form, namely a metric in this alpha beta space, which depends on all these things, and which is uniformly bounded above and below, away from zero in omega, and this is not a big deal for this linear system, such that this combination here is symmetric. Right? So this omega, this H depends on omega. When you dot it with the same omega here, this thing is symmetric in alpha and beta. So this is, you can show that this is a well-known theorem from the 50s, Kreis matrix theorem. And the requirement that one needs, an extra requirement, is for proving the well-posedness, I was referring to this technical condition, is the condition that H should be also smooth in all the variables, including omega. And sometimes that's not easy to prove. So you need this H to be smooth. That has to do with the eigenvalues of omega, how you, if they don't collide, etc. Now, if this H is independent of omega, so that there will be an H for all omegas here in this formula, then we say that the system is symmetric hyperbolic. So symmetric hyperbolic are a subclass of systems in which you just get an H for every omega.
Can that be translated into a statement about the A's?
The statement is that if you lower the index of the A with this H, the A's are symmetric, each one of them.
Right, but if you don't have the H ahead of time, then you figure out just one thing the A's, whether it's symmetric
or not. No. No.
How hard is it to find the H? Is there a construction?
In general, if you want the H of omega, there is a construction. You take all the eigenvectors and the co-eigenvectors, the co-basis of them, and you form a transitional matrix, and with this matrix you do the H. So there is a way,
so
in general.
Or if you can find it, then you just ask, does it in fact depend on the matrix?
You can find it if you know that it's strongly hyperbolic to begin with.
Yeah.
Basically, you just, you use the eigenvectors that you're using.
Right. So if it is strongly hyperbolic, you have a complete set of eigenvectors.
Right.
And then you build this transition matrix from one basis to the other. When, with that matrix, you square it with the inverse and whatever, and you form the H. So there is a procedure to do it. Sure. But you have to check that this matrix is smooth, which is not easy. So if a system is not strongly hyperbolic, then what I was saying today, there is a way of writing sequences of solutions whose initial data has finite norm for all of them, and which blows up in a finite time, right? And there is no way of curing this by saying, okay, this equation is nonlinear. This is a real problem for all systems.
Is there physics where equations are not strongly hyperbolic?
No, I would say that you cannot do physics, because physics means prediction, right? You do the initial data and you predict something. And here, if you make an error, right, then your solution could be far away because there is no continuity between the initial data and the solution. So you lose all prediction.
If you write Einstein equation in a non-hyperbolic form, then is it through the gauge or what's good there? What's the non-physical element?
Well, but the Einstein means solving the whole set of equations, not only the evolution equations. And when you are solving just evolution equations in this bad system, you are introducing many solutions which are not physical.
So you're constraint violating some broad sets of constraints.
Yeah.
Solutions which, isn't it possible that the Navier-Stokes equations don't satisfy this? Because it seems to me if you need to get certain wavelengths, you get things down to the molecular scale across those equations.
I mean, if you think of fluid as an approximation,
right,
then the fluid is strongly hyperbolic, even symmetric, yes.
Okay.
So it's okay,
so
as
never propagate turbulence down to the
right,
down to a small enough level to
I'm confused now. I mean, if you think of another equation, not the thing he has been talking about. I mean, not the Navier-Stokes equation. They are not strong.
Which one?
I mean, the fluid, the perfect.
You other equation.
No, Navier-Stokes is a parabolic,
yes,
right? Parabolic, hyperbolic. It's a mixture. I mean, just a fluid, pure fluid, is strongly hyperbolic. It's symmetric hyperbolic.
Well,
if you do
the Euler equations for pure fluid.
The Euler equations.
You mean no viscosity.
Right, no viscosity. If you introduce viscosity, then there are versions of equations which are these relativistic equations that Lee and Bob did some time ago, which are symmetric hyperbolic. And then there are Navier-Stokes, the usual equations, which are parabolic hyperbolic. But they are not covariant.
Where is the parabolic in the non-relativistic?
You have a Laplacian U, ut equals to Laplacian U times
the velocity is equal to the second derivatives of the velocity in the shear term. So it's basically parabolic.
So let me give you some example of a strongly hyperbolic system. This, I don't know whether this is an example, but I have a chance to be. If you take just...
What did you say?
That probably symmetric hyperbolic even,
yeah,
but we don't know. If you take Maxwell equations in this way, you write a new variable, which is just this. Sorry, here there should be without the anti-symmetrics. Just a straight derivative of A. Then you can write an equation for the electric field and this W, like this. Yeah, but I'm not taking the anti-symmetrizer. Yes, this
what
is
the square
a,
brackets mean?
No, I'm.
No,
this there shouldn't be there.
Oh,
it's a typo.
Oh, okay.
I just saw it. No. So just take without taking the anti-symmetrization. Then you take these two equations. These are, if you put the constraints, the proper constraints, these equations are equivalent to Maxwell's equations. Here, the E is the metric, and there are two constants you can choose for this. Then you can show that the system is symmetric hyperbolic for alpha less than zero and beta less than minus 2/3. And this is the most general symmetrizer that you can build that is out of the three metric only. So this is the most general symmetrizer which is covariant in the three dimension, but it's strongly hyperbolic for all alpha beta such that the product is bigger than zero. So there is a part which is missing. And there is an argument that says, okay, if there were some symmetrizer, some symmetric hyperbolic system, some H, which will not be covariant, but it will make the system symmetric, then by rotating it, you will get many others. And by averaging on them, you will get one which will be invariant, so covariant. So it will be constructed only on the three metrics, but we know that there isn't any for this, for other values of alpha and beta. Of course, this is an argument because you should integrate in a space which is not bounded, right? The space of all transformations you could do in the plane. But nevertheless, it's a good indication. So this system seems to be that, for this system, there are places where it's strongly hyperbolic, not symmetric hyperbolic, and there are some regions where it is symmetric hyperbolic. So this is an example. It's not easy to find simple examples of strongly hyperbolic systems which are not symmetric hyperbolic. And here there is another one. You take the three matrices, upper triangular ones, and you can show that there is no symmetrizer for these ones. Nevertheless, if you do this combination, this is diagonalizable. And what happens there is the danger of not being diagonalizable is that when these two, for instance, these two eigenvalues become the same, there will be a term different from zero here. But you can check that when these two becomes the same for some lambda, this vanishes, and the same for the other. So these are systems which are really strongly hyperbolic.
What about Yang-Mills?
It's like Maxwell. It's the same. So it's in the usual way of writing, it's symmetric hyperbolic.
Oh, no problem. Depends on the matrix A. It's not
on the right. So let's go to some covariant definitions. So now we want to get a definition where you get an equation like in general relativity where everything is contracted, so there is no difference between time and space. Right? So you get a equation there where A depends on the point of the manifold and the unknowns, and you have some source. And for symmetric hyperbolic system, the definition is sort of easy because if you sum two symmetric hyperbolics as two symmetric matrices, you get a symmetric matrix. And so you just say, okay, this system is symmetric hyperbolic if you can find an H such that when you lower these indices with this, this is symmetric for all these vectors. And for some n, this combination, when you dotted this with the n, is positive definite. So this is a definition, and you can define an energy vector with this, which is just this combination here, dotted with some vectors u alpha and u beta, and this is a positive number now, a norm. So it's positive when you dot it with the n. And you can use this energy to show causality. And namely that the velocity of propagation is finite. And there is a property here is that if you take another n, since this is positive definite and this is symmetric, if you take another m, which is this m plus some epsilon omega a, some other vector, for small epsilon, small enough epsilon, you still get positivity. So the set of all n's for which this is positive is an open set. Right, and this is very important because on the proof of where what is the domain of dependence, you take some slice here and you take say a region here and you want to know what is the domain of dependence of this region, so you build an energy integral on this surface and then another one on this one, so this is the normal here. And so you build some energy, which is the integral of EA and A on this one and on this one. And as long as you move on foliations such that this stays positive, you know that the data here will be, I mean, I'm just saying very sloppy, but you control how the data grows here. So in particular, if the data is zero here, you can show that the data will be zero in all this region, as long as I deform this with n's for which this is positive definite, right? And this stops, right, when this n here becomes null, in the sense that this becomes zero for some value of u. So it stops in the first place where where this has a zero eigenvalue. So that's the way one goes on proving finite propagation. So let's see now what we can do for strongly hyperbolic system. So we have the same equation, and we have the following definition. Let's say we have two definitions.
That's where you said the n becomes null. So far, I haven't said anything about a metric.
No, this is a
characteristic.
Yeah, I should say characteristic, not null. It's just because in relativity it's null. So in strongly hyperbolic, you have two definitions, which actually are equivalent. And these are the following. You take an n such that this is invertible, this matrix for some n, and then you look at loops. So I'll write this down here. You take two vectors and consider loops, two covectors, in projective space. Because for this definition, right, you always have this combination of A times omega here. So it doesn't matter the size of the vector. So really it's projective space, no the sign. These are properties where the sign of omega or the size doesn't matter. That's just only the direction. So it's projective space. So this point here is identified with this point. And so you look now for loops here. That comes like this. So this point is identified. So this is a loop, which is non-contractible. And you require that when you move along these loops for each omega, when you move along this loop, you are crossing this metric here. This is along the loop, has kernels. And what you require is when you go through all the loop, you are getting kernels, and you get the whole space when you sum up all these kernels.
So M is the dimension of the space in which U takes value.
This M is the dimension of the space of U's. Right? So this is a global requirement, right? When you move here, you will encounter some places where this metric is non-invertible, and there will be kernels. And when you sum all these kernels, you get the whole space, right? And that tells you also, since this is a loop for lambda reals, which are all the eigenvectors are real. So that tells you that all eigenvectors are real, and that with the eigenvectors, all eigenvalues are real, and with the eigenvectors, you expand the whole space. So it's an usual definition. And now you may ask, what happens if you change the vector here? Take another NA. Can you do still the same construction if you have it for this n? And the answer is yes, and it's a sort of a nice geometrical problem here. But fortunately, there is another definition, which is more in the line of the other one that we have before. It says the system is strongly hyperbolic if there exists an n a such that for each covector omega a, there exists an h that depends on omega, satisfying that this is symmetric, and this thing here is positive definite for all omega. So it's not only symmetric, but positive definite for some n a. Right. That's what the requirement. So this has to be symmetrized for all these h omegas, which is not an easy requirement, but you can check that these two definitions are equivalent.
The third line, the points are part of the
is a remark. It's not part of the definition.
Not part of the definition.
And says that, again, from this definition, it follows that if you add to this vector some piece, still you have the same properties.
But the technical condition is still there, the smoothness.
For showing well-posedness, you need the smoothness of the edge, always. So you have two definitions which are covariant. And actually, this is the one we usually use when you see people say, OK, Einstein's equation in this way of writing are strongly hyperbolic. Basically, that will correspond to that definition.
Is the smooth function of omega, you mean C infinity?
Yes. Yes. That's because when you prove well-postedness in the pseudo-differential calculus, you have to take infinite derivative of omega. One might think that this is a technical condition. It's not real. I mean, but we don't know how to prove it without this condition. So let me introduce now pseudo-differential operators. These are the operators where you have, or equations, system of equations, where the time derivative of u is some operator here which can have this integral differential form. So it's a, you take the Fourier integral of u, put it here, and do this integral over omega. And that's the action. And we can consider operators here where you, if you take this limit, you divide by lambda and multiply by lambda here, and take the limit. If that limit exists, then you say that this operator is first order. That means there is only omega up to first order and then lower order terms. And now if you take this limit here, this is a matrix. Well, there should be an alpha up and a beta there. If you take this limiting thing, this is a metric, and you can check you can ask whether this is strongly hyperbolic, namely if it has a complete set of eigenvectors and all eigenvalues real. And if that is the case, then you can show that this system is well posed also. Right? Why do we want such a system? Well, you can put ADM and BSSN in this form. That's the reason.
Does or doesn't?
You can, yes.
Yes, positive, right?
Yes. Well, I don't have a watch here, and I don't know what time is it.
Halfway?
Okay, we're okay. So the problem of causality. We are going to discuss causality of finite propagation speeds just on the linear level. We just take some solution and look for perturbations of that solution and ask what is the speed or what is the domain of dependence of this linearized equation now. If you know that, you can then by iteration know the domain of dependence of the whole nonlinear system, but the discussion is better if done in this way. And as I say here, you just take a region in a Cauchy surface, sigma zero, and you ask if the data is here, is zero here, where is continues to be zero, independent of what is outside. And if you have a symmetric hyperbolic system, then we have this energy norm here. We contract with an Na. And we know that this is positive, and the place where this is positive is precisely the place for where this determinant is different from zero. So you start with one posit moving with some n here. You start moving like that. You are changing the n, and this can be done until you hit a point where the determinant of this matrix becomes zero. And the surface where this determinant vanishes are what is called the characteristic surface of the system. So here, when you go like this, imagine in just a little bit. When you go like this, the place where you hit the determinant is the Na for which the determinant is zero is a characteristic surface. Right? So if you are thinking in general relativity, you will hit the light cone, which are characteristic surface. And once you are here, for instance, you can get an equation and solve equations like this and get what is the limit of geometrical optics in this sense. Right? You just solve some ordinary differential equations there in the limit of high frequency. So this propagation of high frequencies, they go along characteristics. And that rules this, which in general relativity will be just geodesics. So this, we know the picture for symmetric hyperbolic system. We know that there are characteristics, the speed of propagation is finite. So if the data is zero here, it will be zero in the whole of the cone. So what happens, the question is, what happens now in strongly hyperbolic system? And the difference is that you don't have this energy. Namely, there is an energy, of course, in strong hyperbolic system, but it's a pseudo-differential global thing. It's not nothing that you can just point-wise integrate. Well, for that, you can use the Holmgren's theorem. What it says, Holmgren's theorem, you just take any system like that, don't even have to be hyperbolic, and you consider a region, a hypersurface, like that, doesn't matter, where the data is zero, and you ask, what is the maximal region where the data has to be zero? And if the equation has analytic coefficients, which is a requirement of Holmgren's theorems, then you can show that precisely you can get a foliation of surfaces, starting from the one that you started where the data was zero, inflate this foliation, and all this region will be, in all this region, the field will be zero, except, and this stops when that stops when this the normal to the surface is such that the when you dotted this with the normal, the kernel is different from zero. There is where it stops being. For instance, you can use it. You just can take a region like that and ask, okay, if the data is zero here, where is the data going to be zero in any case? And the answer is, okay, you take a foliation like that until you hit one of these characteristics. For instance, if the equations are elliptic, you know that there is no characteristics. So you can, if the day is the solution is zero, somewhere it's zero everywhere.
Is there any danger you can get two light cones in a general set of equations? Two?
Yeah.
So you could have, I mean,
for many, example, yes.
Elasticity, you have shear waves.
Right. Yes. There are many. And so the domain of dependence is given by the high speed. So the first time you hit one of these. But there will be one, right? When you start blowing this up, there will be one that is first. So you will get the highest, you will hit the highest eigenvalue of that matrix, if you think of it. The identity plus some metric in the space-time picture, you will hit the highest speed.
Maybe they could cross though. I mean, if you have a shear wave, depending on some properties of the fluid, it might speed up in some regions across the.
Yeah, this is a local thing. So in every point you look at this property. Then you can do the geometrical optics or the high frequency limit of these things, and then you follow some line which is coming from a Hamiltonian system. So how are we going to use this Holmgren theorem? Well, the Holmgren theorem is valid for analytic coefficients, and here we don't have analytic coefficients, but we can use strongly hyperbolicity. So what we do is the following. You just imagine this patch here where you want to prove it. You sustain this, glue it to some R3 or Rn or Tn at torus, where you can do the pseudo-differential equations type of things. And you can show that in any case you can get or Rn or Tn or some place where you can do Fourier or series or Fourier transform. Now approximate the equations for a sequence of analytic strongly hyperbolic systems. What you do here is you look at the eigenvectors of this system and you approximate each one of them by a corresponding analytic version of them, and so you do the approximation of the eigenvectors, and then with the eigenvectors you construct the A. So you can build a whole sequence of strongly hyperbolic system. For each one of them, use Holmgren theorems for this data, this particular data that doesn't have to be the data that doesn't have to be analytic or anything, and then you will find that the data, there will be some region here, omega n, where n is the number of the sequence, where this data is going to be remain zero there. And then use that in strongly hyperbolic system, the solution depends continuously on the initial data and on the parameters of the equations to say that if the sequence of solutions un was zero here, then the limited one has to be zero. So you use this sort of argument to show that there will also be a region.
Something which is telling us that this hypersurface is the space-like? I mean, the first argument works also for elliptic equations.
Yes.
You don't care at all. Yeah. Right. But I think in that case, you would expect to have the space-like patterns.
Yeah, I mean, in the sense that this is strongly hyperbolic.
Yeah.
I'm using the strong hyperbolicity to show that there are solutions and so on.
Yeah, but I wonder how it comes in. I mean, you approximate your system by something analytic. For the analytic system, you need not care whether it's space-like or not. Yeah, but I would expect that in this hyperbolic system, you need to care. So at some stage, this should come into the argument.
Yeah. Well, it comes. It comes here, right? Because what I'm saying is I have in this surface, I have a strong initial data, and I can solve for it.
He's making assumptions along the way that rule out elliptic.
I mean,
like approximate the system by an analytic sequence of
the
hyperbolic. Yeah.
So you don't have this continuous dependence on elliptic cloud.
In the elliptic, you will have also.
Yeah, but I mean, in hyperbolic, you only know this if you start from hypersurfaces of this type.
Right.
Yeah. And that comes in the restriction.
Yeah. I mean, you can do things like that for say, symmetric hyperbolic systems and show, right? We have an argument with Jeff many years ago about beaming light, remember? Okay, and this was the way you showed me how to
so
get.
So, what is this? Is you're improving uniqueness here of solutions or what?
No, seeing whether we have a finite speed of propagation, which was unclear for a strongly hyperbolic system.
Oh, but the vanishing is meant to imply that the speed
is fine.
Zero region of the zero region.
Right, because if you put any data here, you cannot modify things inside there. And that was unclear.
This is also how you improve uniqueness of solutions, to show that zero data propagates the zero solution, right?
In the symmetric hyperbolic case. But here you cannot do directly. Because if you try, right, there are energies. You can build an energy here and an energy here, which is the pseudo-differential equation, operators. Now your energy is some pseudo-differential operator. But there is no way of comparing that things here vanish because they are global things. When you go to Fourier transform, you lose locality, basically. There is no way of it. So let me summarize this part. So we have strongly differential, pseudo-differential systems, which we know are well-posed. There are global energy norms. In the case of strongly hyperbolic systems, they are pseudo-differential operators, these norms. There are covariant definitions. And you can move the ends and both definitions such that you can play like this. Then you can show that they have finite propagation speeds. And the domain of dependence, you can show that also is bounded by characteristic surfaces. For symmetric hyperbolic systems, this we didn't discuss, but they are well adapted by finite difference schemes where you respect summation by parts. What is the equivalent for strongly hyperbolic system? How do you analyze strongly hyperbolic system in the numerical realm? Well, you use pseudo-spectral method. So this is a closer what Mark and Lee are doing. Yeah. If you look at how people analyze this system, they are just precisely doing the analysis of pseudo-differential operators. So now let me go to some applications. So one application is how to deal with ADM, BSSN, first order, first, second order systems, right? So this I'm going to go. We have to go fast. You have some rendition of ADM equations. Well, there was more equations, that's right. Right, that's the dot, dot, dot part. No, well, this is important. Right? This part is important, unfortunately. So you have two evolution equations, two constraints equations. So we are going to deal with the evolution equations. You write them down in full generality. This way, I mean, these are the dot, dot parts that don't bother much. This is a principal part of the equations. They are second order in H, so how do you fit them into this setting of strongly hyperbolic system? And what you do is the following. You first consider the principal part, just forget about lower order terms. Frisk coefficients, so the coefficients in front you think as constants. Substitute all derivatives by Fourier transforms. And define a new variable, which is just I omega times HIJ. In this setting, in the, if you prefer to do without hats, then this is an operator, which is a pseudo-differential operator, just the square root of the Laplacian in front of the operator. Then you get this, when you write this H as else, you get this system. And that now is a first order system, pseudo-differential system, has an omega here. Knowing this is square root of the Laplacian. And so you can analyze this system. This falls into the system of pseudo-differential operator, first order. So we know that it's well posed if it's strongly hyperbolic. So now you can ask whether this system is strongly hyperbolic. Result. This system, which is ADM, in some rendition of it, is not strongly hyperbolic. It's just weakly hyperbolic. You will have three eigenvectors which are missing. You can try to modify it, adding some constraints to it into the Hamiltonian and modifying the Laplace this way. And you get a new term here, a B. And if you take B bigger than zero or any B, the equation is still weakly hyperbolic, but for B, bigger than zero, you have only two eigenvectors missing. And if you add the Hamiltonian constraint, you can show that nothing happens. The analysis is very easy. Just look at this part of the problem. What happens with the BSSN equations? Well, there you define a new variable F, which you can add some terms like that, but this is just a coordinate transformation, doesn't matter really. And so you get now three evolution equations where you use this definition and take a time derivative of theta and substitute here by the corresponding part of the ADM equations. And you get this, where here we have added with this constant C the constraints equations, the momentum constraint. So you get this system, you do the play the same game, namely do the hyperbolicity analysis of that system, defining L again, and you get that system. And you can analyze this. And for these values of the constraints, the system is strongly hyperbolic. The eigenvalues are these. And you have all the whole set of eigenvectors. So this, what I wanted to show with that is that if you have a favorite system of equations, to analyze whether the system is strongly hyperbolic is relatively easy. Just go define this new variable, take the highest, the principal part of the equations, consider all coefficients, just the metric 1, minus 1, 1, 1, everything like that, and you analyze that system. If you look at all the eigenvectors, if it has a complete set of eigenvectors, and all the eigenvalues are real, you are done. The system is well posed. From there, you can play the games of, say, running things numerically, etc. But it's a sort of easy calculation.
What's the statement, Dave? You started with the second order system.
Yes.
And then you you prove something that is in the first order system formulation. Does that mean that if you rewrite the second order system as a first order system, then it will be strongly hyperbolic?
Yeah. I'm rewriting it first order.
You're rewriting it as a first order system.
Right.
You're doing a Fourier transform.
Right. So I'm defining a new variable Aij, which is a square root of the Laplacian times Aij.
So what does this say about the second order system that you started with? I
mean, well, it's the same system basically. We're rewriting it in a different equation.
Data differently for the second order system than you would for the first order system. First order system, you need to give a lot more data, right?
No, the same data. For the first order, I will give this. For the second, I will give this.
You had second derivatives of the H's in the original equation. Right?
No, this way, right? It's an omega.
You had second derivatives of the H's in the original
right.
equation.
I mean, still for this system, I have to give H and K.
What about the gradient, spatial gradients of H?
No.
You don't have to give the spatial gradients of H.
Yeah.
He's asking what happens to the second space derivative of H.
And now our first derivative of L.
That's his question. What happens to the second space derivative?
Yeah, no, that's my question.
You have omega H there in the dk. There it is. These terms there. And then you add this other equation, which is brings in the square root of
Boston. Yeah, so all the omegas are here, right? Yeah. These are the directions.
Is it the case when you are proving the bottom of the energy that in this system when you reduce the first order, the norm contains the special derivative of the bar, but in the R case it doesn't, so you can bound one with the R.
So now I can take this system and look at the energy, right? And the energy will have things like Lij squared, which are just Laplacian of Hij.
Another second derivative.
Square root like this. And these are just gradient of H, if you want to integrate by parts and all this. So it's the same.
I mean, my question really is, you start out with a system in second differential form.
Yes.
And in this analysis is for systems in this first differential form. Okay. And so somehow you're rewriting the system in first differential form to carry out the analysis, and that's effectively by this Fourier technique. But now if I think of a simple system just like the wave equation in the second order form,
yes.
If I want to really write that in first order form, then I have to give
many other variables
constraints. Include
the
spatial derivatives of the scalar field, and have constraints that these are really the derivatives of the field or whatever.
Yeah.
Okay. The system gets more complicated.
So we don't want to get complicated for the analysis.
So when you prove that this thing is strongly hyperbolic, can I then just throw away the first order system, this first order picture, and just finite difference the second order one?
Yeah, I mean, you will have to respect the energies that you will get from that. And God will help you with
this
that.
This is what we like to do, but...
Yeah.
So.
But the thing here is that you don't have to increase the variables of the system, now consider a huge system with many more eigenvectors, etc. Just the small system, still is the same calculation. Because all what you are doing here is looking at the high frequency limit and see that responds okay. So if you can think always of that as a high frequency limit. And this way of taking L instead of H, what it's doing is just putting things at the equal footing so that your norm is an L2 norm.
Well, I mean, the way you're describing this analysis and this criterion didn't matter whether I had a first order formulation or not. So you're saying I can just start with a second order formulation and never worry about transforming it to a first order version.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, but I mean,
you have to worry.
Not really what he's saying.
Your different scheme will respect integration by parts well enough that his norm is still worth it.
Correct.
For the numerical things. For numerical things, you can say if you do equations in a torus, then you can use pseudo-differential method, and the things will go through, no problem. if you have boundaries or other things, it's going to be a mess.
So
I'll find a difference.
So that was my question about boundaries. So suppose that I took a second order system and now I wanted to impose boundary conditions on it. And for hyperbolic systems, we know that you can only specify ingoing characteristic fields. If you, so you wrote down what the eigenvalues are. If I wanted the eigenvectors, which are the basically the characteristic fields, do those now involve L instead of
yes.
A and F? And so those, so if you were going to evolve the second order system, all of your eigenvectors would now have explicit derivatives in them. Is that correct?
Yeah, we'll have the square root of the Laplacian then.
Yeah.
Well, it's more complicated than that because you have a square root of a Laplacian there. If you do a pseudo-differential, it's easy. You know how to do this.
Right, but if you'd actually...
But if you do finite differences...
If you'd actually be trying to impose boundary conditions on characteristic fields, just defining those characteristic fields, you would have something that would be difficult to evaluate.
Yes, but in pseudo-differentials, it's going to be easy. Right. In the finite difference, it's not.
Okay.
But so this is a, if you want, this is an analysis for the interior. Right? For the boundaries, you have to do all this Kreis and Gustafsson.
Okay, but if you had a first order system, then it would be easy.
Yes.
Couldn't you just say that these are all, you're looking at all the conditions, all several sets of necessary conditions. One is to go through this analysis.
Yes.
It's necessary, but I mean, it's actually among all sets of necessary conditions, for some that are better than others. So, I mean, isn't this the Hormander approach going through Holmgren's theorem and all like this? As opposed to, it's not the Leray approach.
No.
But it's, I can see it's very similar. I mean, Holmgren, you're using Holmgren is like using Kosciuszko-Lebesgue in the.
If only for proving that part, only for the finite speed, the analyticity doesn't enter in any other place.
I understand analyticity doesn't. I mean, you use it as an intermediate tool.
Yeah, only for finite, for only. I mean, if you look at the say Taylor's book where these things are, they don't use pseudo-differential calculus. They use analyticity. Yeah.
So I'm confused at a sort of simpler level. I was expecting you to sort of say from your remarks in the beginning that you discovered that the alien operations were not strong and hyperbolic, and therefore we'd have to impose some gauge condition.
Right.
So are these equations somehow connected? Can they be viewed as a special?
Well, there are two things. One is gauges, and one is the real equations. I mean, the evolution equations, for instance, are not unique because you can always add the constraints.
Right.
So there are combinations which are bad, and there are combinations which are good.
Independent of
the gauge. Here is a lapsis densitized and shift is zero, or fixed.
Oh, so that is a gauge.
Yeah. I mean, that's for all. IDM is the same, but the IDM, for instance, only weakly hyperbolic.
The
even with that.
It won't matter in this. I mean, you just replace T by T minus the shift.
Right. Well, it's here, right? But it doesn't matter.
Unless you make the shift an explicit function of the metric or something.
Right.
If you would do that, then everything would change. That's why we don't do it.
Contemporaries with Charlie's in the early days of ADM. I mean, Jim Anderson looked at the problem of making the Laplace and shift functionals of the canonical variables, and this became a nightmare, as I recall.
So in a way, for second-order system, one has to introduce a first-order piece, at least.
So can we say that GR is strongly hyperbolic independent of gauge, if we use this particular way?
No, I don't know what that statement is still. I hope someday we will have a statement like, OK, look, this theory is strongly hyperbolic independent of gauge. And well, there is one which says that the shift is anything. And the Laplace is a densitized Laplace, so you don't give the Laplace, but some square root of the Laplace, some
prescribed function.
Yeah,
it's fixed somehow.
There is still a lot of freedom, of course. I mean, you can put in any chord, right? If you know the solution, you can always write the solution in the gauge with this, because just look at what the Laplace is, what the shift is, densitize the shift and the laps and prescribe that one on the shift. So it contains all the renditions. So.
What if you try to do the analysis naively, take the Einstein tensor, replace the second time derivative by some regressive in first order in time form and do this, right, the machinery basically?
But for that, I need to have some equations where I have the t here. I don't want to have equations where I have x only, say x, y, z, because that's a part of the constraint. You can play, there is a formula to play with all the things. That's the way Geros does it. It has the whole equations together and looks at hyperbolization. Hyperbolizations just take a subset of equations, which are evolution, and then you look at there for the symmetric or strong hyperbolic. You can do a lot of that. See? But I don't know how to do the analysis in that general. So let me, what is the time?
It's
11:30. Okay, let me go on a bit with constraint propagation, which is another application where strongly hyperbolic systems are needed, apparently. And what is referring to what you just mentioned. Suppose you have an evolution system like that. And suppose you have a constraints which are first order, say. So there will be some metrics here, k, some space of constraint variables, and some equation like that. So the constraints are also quasi-linear, namely, they have the first derivative, highest order. U can be here, but no more than that. And you have another term which can have u on any function we like. So many systems fixes are like that. And there will be some interoperability condition, which I'm assuming at the moment, because I don't know how to get from here to here is a step that is quite difficult in general. But I'm going to assume that there is an interoperability condition that gives you an equation like that. How will you go to get that equation? Well, you will take a t derivative of that part. You will get then substitute all the u's by this formula, ut is there. Play some algebra, and then if there is an interability condition, it should have this formula, right? Because second derivative of u can only account for this first derivative of c. It has to be linear in that term, so this is a linear system or semi-linear system, and there will be a rest which will be also proportional to c. Why do we need this? Because the integrability condition tells me that if this is zero at the initial surface, the time derivative also should be zero, right? So it should depend only on the fields on the surface and its derivatives. And I cannot get more than first derivative because this is a first order system. So you should have this formula. So this we call the subsidiary system, because this is a system where the constraint quantities will propagate. You might say analytically you don't need this because if the constraints are zero, they remain zero. But we know in numerical problems that this is important because this C is never zero, so you want to study this. And even for imposing boundary conditions, you need to know what the system is. So the question
is. Also, analytically, you need to know that. I mean, you need a uniqueness statement, so you need some information.
Yes, some. But it might be less than what we are getting. You only need uniqueness, but here we need to know how to propagate it also. So the question is which properties of this system will this system inherit? Any? Some? So that's a question. And the problem is that in general, this S is not unique. And that happens if there is some conditions with this L, right? There are many S's. So because if there is some L which contracted with this, which might depend on omega, then we could add to this S a term like this, and it will be the same integrability condition. So how do we go around this? And there are very simple systems where this is the case. It's the simplest system you can imagine, you can build constraint that has this property. And if you add this term, you have the freedom. Your system can be anything. Even the best strongly hyperbolic, symmetric hyperbolic system, ordinary differential system, your constraint system gets very bad. You get non-dual pose, badly dual pose. So we assume something, and this map, this K here, which was in the previous, was this K here. So that's entering the definition of the C. That this K, when I dotted it with an omega, any omega, is a surjective map. You may ask, is there any system that satisfies this? Well, you can find that in Maxwell and Einstein-Christoffel, for instance, there is a subset of constraints which do satisfy this condition, not the whole set of constraints.
But it's surjective?
It means that if this is zero, onto. If you put a U here and this becomes zero, then the U is zero. That you map the image is the whole set. That the image is the whole set. So there are, in all examples, not all examples, in Maxwell and Einstein-Christoffel, you can show that there is a subset of constraints that satisfy this. And the rest of the constraints just propagate like ordinary differential equations once this constraints are taken care of. Well, the integrability condition, if you look at the way I was describing how to get it, you find out that you need this, this implies this. Implies that condition. So the symmetrized derivative on this space-time indices, or space indices in this case, and this combination has to be zero. And then from there, it's very easy to get the following results. Given any non-vanishing omega, if this pair is an eigenvalue, eigenvector of A, omega, then this pair that you build with the K is an eigenvector, eigenvalue, eigenvector of S with omega. To do that, just construct this equation twice with omega and apply the U here, and you will get it. If this B is different from zero, of course. So what we get here is that if the B is different from zero, we have the same eigenvector, the same eigenvalue. And we know how the eigenvector is. It's as this one. And so we have some corollaries here. If the evolution system is strongly hyperbolic, then so is the subsidiary system. Why is that? Because if I have a complete set of eigenvectors here, and this map is surjective, then I cover with this, dotting with this U here, so I cover the whole space of the constraints. So I have a complete set of eigenvectors of the S. But since I have a complete set of eigenvector of S, I know all the eigenvalues, and they are real, because in the first system they were real. So you conclude that if the A is strongly hyperbolic, then the S is also strongly hyperbolic. And furthermore, the second corollary is just in what I said already, is that the characteristics, namely the sigmas, the eigenvectors, the eigenvalues of the subsidiary system are a subset of the eigenvalues of the initial system. In particular, that tells you that the domain of dependence of the subsidiary system is at least as big as the domain of dependence of the initial system. And you might think, okay, what happens if the system A is symmetric hyperbolic? Can you get that the S is also symmetric hyperbolic? And no, we have a counterexample of that. Right. So you need strongly hyperbolicity. You cannot get from, say, symmetric to symmetric. So there you need strong hyperbolicity.
But you could.
You could,
but it doesn't follow.
It doesn't follow, and there are counterexamples. Yeah. So if you want to prove it in general, you can't.
You can, but right. You might prove it in particular.
Yes.
You're in a certain position to get this research, in the strongly hyperbolic case. Could there be conditions in the symmetric hyperbolic case which replaces and then you get this research also?
I don't know, because the only condition I can think of in the K And that, for that, I have a, there is a counterexample. There is a system which is, I mean, one of these Einstein-Christoffel system is symmetric hyperbolic, obviously, but the constraints, the evolution of the constraints only strongly hyperbolic.
Yeah, but I guess, I mean, here you could have the symmetric strongly hyperbolic system and your condition is not satisfied, and then also you don't get this for the subsidiary system. So I guess there are examples
of
strongly hyperbolic systems which violate your condition, and the subsidiary system is not strongly hyperbolic.
Right.
Yeah, so it's not quite clear. Maybe one could do something about symmetric hyperbolic as well.
Yeah, maybe. Yeah?
Can I just make a remark? I mean, Einstein's equations don't care about any mathematical development of hyperbolic. I mean, this is just all historical stuff. Nobody really understands the nonlinear, let's say, the quasi-linear case. Right? So there are different approaches that can follow. But if you just, the reason it's hard, it seems to me, I mean, all you really want is that the initial data have a domain of dependence, and we would like it be determined by the speed of light. That's really all you want. And all these are ways of getting at that, but they don't cover every possibility. So the real problem, it seems to me, is, I mean, Demetrius and other people are going after, more general definitions of hyperbolicity.
Mm-hmm.
And Demetrius is does not useful. I mean, he says what I just said. If it has a domain of dependence, then the system should be regarded as hyperbolic. But the trouble, as you know, with Einstein's equation is the coefficients of the operators depend on the solution, I mean, that you're developing. So you can not make indefinite long statements like these guys developed hyperbolicity with a fixed metric in them. Loret and Herminder,
mm-hmm.
and all these guys. But we have a bigger problem. Everything looks great in some of Helmholtz systems and some other systems, but if some metric starts losing its uniform ellipticity or positivity or something like that, then it all blows up.
Yeah.
I mean, so the real question is there a more general, I mean, about gauges and so forth, is there a more general way to define hyperbolicity such that it just captures the one property the physicist wants?
Well, but I mean, you need these properties, right? Because suppose you are in a slice and you are doing numerical evolution. You are in a slice and it becomes null at some point.
Yeah.
You.
I mean,
somebody can tell, okay, if you take another slice, another gauge, you might be able to evolve or go to.
Gauge invariant case.
Yeah.
There should be.
Yeah, there should be a way.
Looking at it, and this is what Demetrius and other people have tried to find. Is a definition of hyperbolicity that just amounts to that. Doesn't matter about the slices, but of course you break through the curve at some point, so mm-hmm. then you lose it. Otherwise, so I'm just trying to say that this is
yeah.
one way of approaching hyperbolicity. The emphasis is on strong hyperbolicity.
Yes.
But I mean, physics doesn't know anything about some of these mathematical
theories. Right. In particular, what I like is symmetric hyperbolicity because that makes
yes.
more contact with the numerical things. Right? All numerical techniques of stability, or most of them, are based in energy norms, and you need, I mean, that's a good starting point for doing many things. So you can mimic in the numerical analysis, the analytic case, and for some things it's very useful.
When I first learned about hyperbolicity was in terms of the second order thing, and you just look at the metric,
mm-hmm.
and it's
yeah.
a question of what signature is. That's all it came down to, and it seems to me that this is all getting very complicated because of the fact that the mathematicians went this way to cover fluid dynamics, which is a first order system, and that they forgot about this, the second order system is run out of style mathematically.
Every second order system that has that property, you put in symmetric first order form.
Yeah, but when you do that, the Einstein's
but the converse
isn't true. It becomes more complicated.
Not really.
Okay, but the old way will tell you the difference between weakly hyperbolic and strongly hyperbolic, and you do want that. Because the weakly hyperbolic case in the merits, I'm going to call
Not in the merits, it's physics.
Well, there's more than physics here. That's the problem. I mean, we all learned that from the mathematicians that the right way to think about manifolds is in terms of their coordinate independent properties. But no one has figured out how to tell a computer to produce a coordinate independent visualizable manifold. Well, for us, computers have something to do with it.
Yes, but that's good, right.
To solve, we want to practically solve Einstein's equations. And that means even if you knew space-time manifold in some mathematical independent way, you would still have to throw a net of coordinates on it.
That's right. You're preaching to the choir here.
Right. Okay. So that net of coordinates is what's causing the problem. How do you throw the coordinates onto the manifold?
That's not the only problem.
Well, it certainly is part of it. I'm willing to believe.
It's part of it. Yeah.
Willing to believe that Einstein propagates causally, and I'm not willing to believe that every imaginable coordinate system you want to throw at it has nice properties.
There you go. If we propagate the coordinates causally, like make them solve a wave equation, then it's obvious that the metric solves a wave equation.
The function is positive, and the space metric is uniformly positive.
Yeah. I mean, there are good coordinates, locally, and you can build bad coordinates, so where things become just nastier as you like.
Right, but I mean, still, if the lattice function is strictly positive, and the space metric is uniformly positive, well, let's say both uniformly positive, then that coordinate system is fine. Uniformly positive. I mean, maybe you'll get trouble with the computer because something will get smaller than epsilon, we'll get down to epsilon, and epsilon, you know, if it's uniform, it can't go under epsilon. But epsilon is not good for the computer, then I agree. That's a problem numerically.
No, I think you can still do things like having a coordinate which is nice and smooth, and then you add to that some high frequency thing, and that will screw.
That's the same thing as the smallest problem.
Well, but it's not in the right geometric, will look like positive definite.
No,
but the derivatives will.
If the frequency gets large, the wavelength gets small, and its frequency goes to infinity, the wavelength is smaller than anything.
Yeah.
Name. But if I said something is uniformly positive, I mean.
No, but it's positive. It's positive because you put.
Not uniformly positive. Because.
What do you mean? It's
uniformly.
It will be bounded away from 0 by 2, say.
Yeah.
Right. So I just do a coordinate which is smooth, first derivative smooth, second derivative very rough. Right. So the metric in the new coordinate will be.
That's why we use sublet.
Will be nice, smooth, but in your equations will be screwed because the derivative of Christoffel will go.
I'm sorry, I meant in the sense of solar.
Yeah.
Okay. So that's how it
would be. Okay, so I'll finish.